This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. Thank you. I'm Anthony Arnov. It's truly an honor to be here tonight to introduce Marks and Soho. I had the privilege to be on this stage with Howard Zinn for two performances of Voices of People's History of the United States presented by Lannan Foundation, and it's really an honor to be back here. I'd like to thank Patrick Lannan and Lannan Foundation, the staff and board, for bringing Marks and Soho to Santa Fe tonight, for so many years of important public programming in this city and around the country. And for the remarkable support of art, of engagement, critical inquiry, and resistance. Howard Zinn wrote this play that you'll see tonight, Marks in Soho, which is his third play, at a moment in the 1990s when people around the world were once again loudly announcing the death of socialism. As the world witnessed the collapse of Stalinist dictatorships, beginning with the mass demonstrations tearing down the Berlin Wall, commentators consistently said it was Marxist regimes that were being overthrown. We were told that the United States had eliminated any ideological alternative to free market capitalism. In the words of New York Times columnist and House pundit of the plutocrats, Thomas Friedman. Republican President George Bush, the first George Bush, declared the dawning of a new world order of peace and prosperity. An obscure State Department official, Francis Fukuyama, became famous for arguing that we had reached the end of history. From now on, he wrote, politics would revolve around how to tinker with capitalism. Fukuyama said that Western capitalism represented the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the final form of human government. We could now anticipate, he said, accumulation without end. But Howard Zinn, as he did throughout his life, rightly rejected all this as nonsense. He knew capitalism would again go into crisis and that people would again look for alternatives, as we have dramatically seen across the globe over the past several years. He swam against the stream of triumphalism when few others did to debunk the myths of capitalism and to reclaim the genuinely radical and democratic and very human Karl Marx, who you will see soon on this stage tonight. I first met Howard in person through his invitation to attend a reading of Marx in Soho at a small theater in Boston. Sitting there with just a few dozen of Howard's friends and his wife Roz, I was captivated. As soon as the lights came up, I made my way over to Howard and asked if I could publish the play as a book, to which he immediately agreed. But as excited as I was for people to read the play, I was even more eager to find a way for audiences to see it performed. And here I will take some small credit for having one of the better ideas of my years of organizing public events. As I thought of who could embody this compelling character, I did not envision some older, white, bearded Germanic actor, the central casting conception of every caricatured Marx we've ever seen on television and stage, but a young African-American actor with tremendous comic timing, great youthful energy, and a keen appreciation for ideas, as well as an activist in his own right, my friend Brian Jones, who at the time was then in his mid-20s. And so, in a small college classroom in Boston, pushing back chairs in a classroom to make room for a performance that Brian did just for myself, Roz, and Howard, began a journey that would see Brian perform this play in scores of theaters and non-traditional venues across the country for now more than 12 years. A few words about Brian Jones. Brian has remained an activist and an educator. He's taught in public schools for almost a decade in Harlem and more recently in Brooklyn, and has changed the lives of thousands of his students. Furthermore, he's become a nationally recognized leader of the movement to defend teachers and their unions from the vicious attacks that politicians are mounting with increased ferocity. Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education Diane Ravitch rightly called Brian's writings in defense of public education brilliant, and NBC invited Brian to participate in a televised debate on these issues. He's marched, he's rallied, organized, educated, agitated, and worked in the trenches, not just in the fight for quality education and strong democratic unions led by the rank and file, but also in struggles against war and for civil rights. In recent Occupy the Department of Education protests, Brian led thousands of teachers, students, and parents in using bold and creative tactics to challenge the rubber stamp committee of bureaucratic puppets appointed by the mayor of New York, billionaire one percenter Michael Bloomberg, to advance his agenda of privatizing schools and destroying teachers' unions. In the spirit of celebrating people's history, Brian's writing and speaking on African-American politics and history has been part of a vital collective project to reclaim the radical tradition of the civil rights movement. Haymarket Books, where I am on the editorial board, is very honored that next month we're publishing a book that Brian is a contributor to called Education and Capitalism, and we're also thrilled that next year we will be publishing Brian's first book. Like Howard Zinn, Brian does this work with an infectious joy and laughter and a sense that there's no better, more meaningful life than one lived in struggle, working alongside others to turn this topsy-turvy world right side up. So I hope you will welcome me, join me in welcoming Karl Marx to this stage. Thank you.
Thank God, an audience. Good of you to come. You weren't put off by all those idiots who said Marx is dead. Well, I am. And I'm not. That's dialectics for you. You might be wondering how I got here. Public transportation. I didn't want to return here. I wanted to return to Soho. That's where I lived in London. But a bureaucratic mix-up, and here I am. Soho, New York. Well, I always wanted to visit New York. Why have I returned? To clear my name. I've been reading your newspapers. They're all declaring that my ideas are dead. It's nothing new. These clowns have been saying this for over 160 years. Don't you wonder why is it necessary to declare me dead again and again? Well, I've had it up to here. I asked for the right to come back for a short while. I told you, there are rules. It's a bureaucracy. It is permitted to read, even to watch, not to travel. I protested, of course, and had some support. Socrates told them the untraveled life is not worth living. Gandhi fasted. Mother Jones threatened to picket. Buddha chanted. Oh. Mark Twain even came to my defense in his own strange way. But the others kept quiet. My God, at this point, what have they got to lose? Yes, there too, I have a reputation as a troublemaker. And there too, protest works. Finally, they said, all right, you can go. You can have an hour or so to speak your mind, but remember, no agitating. They do believe in freedom of speech, but within limits. They are liberals. So you can spread the word. Marx is back. But understand one thing. I am not a Marxist. I once said that to Pieper, and he almost croaked. I should tell you about Pieper. We were living in London at the time, Jenny and I, and the little ones, two dogs, three cats, two birds, hardly living. A little flat on Dean Street, right near where they dumped the city sewage. We were in London because I had been expelled from the continent, expelled from the Rhineland, yes, from my birthplace. I had done dangerous things. I was the editor of a newspaper, the Rheinische Zeitung. Hardly revolutionary, although I suppose the most revolutionary act one can engage in is to tell the truth. You see, the police in the Rhineland were arresting poor people for gathering firewood from the estates of the rich. I wrote an editorial protesting that. They decided to censor our newspaper. I wrote an editorial declaring there was no freedom of the press in Germany. They decided to prove me right. They shut us down. Only then did we become radical. Isn't that the way it is? Our final issue of Zeitung had a huge headline in red ink. Revolt. That annoyed the authorities. They ordered me out of the Rhineland. So we went to Paris. Where else do exiles go? Where else can you stay up all night and drink wine in a cafe and tell lies about how revolutionary you were in the old country? If you're going to be an exile, be one in Paris. Paris was our honeymoon. Jenny found a tiny flat in the Latin Quarter. Heavenly months. Soon the word was out. From the German police to the Paris police. Seems the police develop an internationalist consciousness long before the workers. So we expelled, went to Belgium, expelled again, and then we came to London, where the political refugees come from all over the world. The British are admirable in their tolerance and insufferable in their boasting about it. The doctors said the throat cough would go away in a few weeks. That was in 1858. So anyway, I was telling you about Pieper. You see, in London, the political refugees from the continent marched in and out of our house. Pieper was one of them. He was a flatterer, a sycophant. He buzzed around me like a hornet. He would station himself 6 inches from me so that I could not evade him, and he would quote from my writings. I used to say, Pieper, please do not quote me to myself. He had the audacity to say, thinking I would be pleased, that he would translate Das Kapital into English. The man could not speak one sentence of English without butchering it. English is a beautiful language. It is Shakespeare's language. If Shakespeare had heard Pieper speak one sentence of English, he would have taken poison. Jenny felt sorry for him. She used to like to invite him to our family dinners. One evening, he came over and he announced the formation of the Marxist Society of London. A Marxist society, I asked. What's that? He said, we meet every week to discuss another of your writings. We read aloud and examine sentence by sentence. That's why we call ourselves Marxists. We believe completely and wholeheartedly in everything you've ever written. Completely and wholeheartedly, I asked. Yes, and we would be honored, Herr Dr. Marx. He always called me Mr. Dr. Marx. You know, if you would address the next meeting of the Marxist Society. I cannot do that. Why not? Because I am not a Marxist. I didn't mind his bad English. Mine wasn't always so perfect. It was his way of thinking. He was an embarrassment, a satellite encircling my words, reflecting them to the world, but distorting them, and then defending the distortions like a fanatic, denouncing anyone who interpreted them differently. I said to Jenny, do you know what I fear most? She said, that the workers' revolution will never come. I said, no. The revolution will come, but when it does, it'll be taken over by men like Pieper. flatterers when out of power, bullies and braggarts when holding power, dogmatists. They will speak for the proletariat. They will interpret my ideas for the world. They'll organize a new hierarchy, a new priesthood, with excommunications and indexes, inquisitions and firing squads, all this in the name of communism. They'll divide the world between capitalist empires and communist empires. They'll muck up our beautiful dream. And it will take another revolution, maybe two or three, to clean it up. That's what I fear. No. I was not going to have Pieper translate Das Kapital. It represented 15 years of work in the conditions of Soho, making my way every morning past the bodies of beggars, sleeping amidst the sewage, then on to the British Museum, there with its magnificent library, working until dusk, reading. Is there anything more boring than reading political economy? Writing political economy. Then home through the darkening streets, past the vendors calling out the prices of their wares. Veterans of the Crimean War. Some blind, others without legs, begging for a penny in the noxious air. The poor smell of London, yeah. Some of my critics, trying to minimize what went into Das Kapital, would say, as they always say about radical writers, "Oh, he must have had some dreadful personal experience." Yes! If you want to make much of it, that walk home through Soho fueled the anger that went into Das Kapital. But I hear you saying, well, of course, that was then, over a century ago. Only then, on my way here this morning, I walked through the streets of your city, surrounded by garbage, breathing foul air, past the bodies of men and women sleeping on the street, huddled against the cold. Instead of a lassie singing a ballad, I heard a voice in my ear, "Some change, sir, for a cup of coffee." Do you call this progress? Because you have motor cars, flying machines, 1,000 potions to make you smell better, and people sleeping on the street. An official report. Last year, the United States gross domestic product, yes, gross, was $7,000 billion. Whew. Most impressive. Tell me, where is it? Who is profiting from it? Who is not? Less than 500 individuals control $2,000 billion in business assets. Are these individuals more noble, more hardworking, more valuable to society than the mother in the tenement nursing 3 children through the winter without any money to pay the heating bill? Didn't you hear me say 160 years ago that capitalism would greatly increase the wealth of the world, but that that wealth would be concentrated into fewer and fewer hands? Goldman Sachs. I'll say no more. Do you know the Oliver Goldsmith poem, The Deserted Village? Ill fares the land to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulates and men decay. That's what I saw as I walked through the streets of your city, buildings decaying, schools decaying, people decaying. But then I walked a bit farther, And I was suddenly surrounded by men of obvious wealth, women in jewels and furs. Suddenly I heard the sound of sirens. Was a crime being committed somewhere nearby? Was violence being done? Was somebody trying to take a part of the gross domestic product? Illegally! From those who have stolen it legally! Ah, the wonders of the market system! Human beings reduced to commodities, their lives controlled by the super commodity, money! The committee doesn't like that. In that little flat on Dean Street, we had hot soup and boiled potatoes. Fresh bread from our friend the baker down the street. We'd sit around the dinner table and discuss the latest events of the day. The Irish struggle for freedom, the latest war, the stupidity of the country's leaders, the political opposition confining itself to pips and squeaks, the cowardly press. I suppose things are different these days. After dinner, we would clear the table and I would work. With a glass of beer, my cigars handy. Yes, work. Till 3 or 4 in the morning. Books piled up on one side, parliamentary reports piled up on the other. And across the table, Jenny was transcribing. My handwriting was impossible. She rewrote every word I wrote. Can you imagine a more heroic act? Occasionally a crisis. Not a world crisis. A book would be missing. I said to Jenny, have you seen my Ricardo? She said, you mean Principles of Political Economy. She thought I was finished with it. She had taken it to the pawn shop. I lost my temper. My Ricardo? You pawned my Ricardo? She said, be quiet. Just last week, didn't we pawn the ring my mother gave me? That's how it was. We pawned everything, especially gifts from Jenny's family. And when we were finished with those, we pawned our clothes. One winter, do you know the London winters? I went without my overcoat. Another time I walked outside, my feet began to freeze on the snow. And then I realized I'm not wearing shoes. We'd pawned them the day before. When Capital was published, we celebrated with a big dinner, but Engels had to give us some money so we could retrieve our linens and dishes from the pawn shop. Engels, a saint. There's no other word for him. Whenever the water was cut off, the gas cut off, the house was dark, our spirits low, Engels paid the bills. His family owned factories in Manchester. Yes, capitalism saved us. Okay. But he did not always understand our needs. We had no money for groceries, and he would show up with crates of wine. One Christmas, we had no means to afford a Weihnachtsbaum. A Christmas tree. Engels shows up with 6 bottles of champagne. So we imagined a tree, formed a circle around it, drank champagne, and sang Christmas songs. Now, I know what my revolutionary friends were thinking. Marx, the atheist, a Christmas tree. It's true. I did say that religion is the opium of the people, but no one has ever paid attention to the full passage. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. It is the heart in a heartless world, the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. True, opium may not be a solution. Sometimes it is necessary to relieve pain. Don't I know that from my boils? Doesn't the world have a terrible case of the boils? I keep thinking about Jenny, how she loaded up all of our possessions, carried our children across the channel to London, and then gave birth 3 times in that miserable flat on Dean Street, nursed those babies, and tried to keep them warm, but saw them die. one by one. Guido, he had not even begun to walk. Francesca, she was 1 year old. I had to borrow £3 to pay for her coffin. Moosh lived almost 8 years. Something was wrong from the start. He had a large, handsome head. The rest of him never grew. The night he died, we all slept around his body on the floor. So when Eleanor was born, we were fearful. She was a tough little thing. She was fortunate to have two older sisters, Jenishin and Laura. They were lucky to survive themselves. Jenishin, our first, was born in Paris. Paris, he is marvelous for lovers, miserable for children. Something about the air. Laura, our second, was born in Brussels. No one should be born in Brussels. You know, in Paris, we had no money, but we always had family picnics. We'd walk a mile and a half into the countryside, Jenishin, Laura, Lenchen. I'll tell you about Lenchen. Lenchen would make a roast veal. We would have tea and cheese and fruit bread and beer. Eleanor was the youngest, but she drank beer. No money, but children need a vacation. One time with the groceries money, I sent them to the Atlantic coast of France. Another time with the rent money, I bought a piano. Because the girls loved music. Now, a father is not supposed to have favorites among his children, but Eleanor. I used to say to Jenny, Eleanor's a strange child. She would say, do you expect the children of Karl Marx to be normal? Eleanor was the youngest, the brightest. Imagine a revolutionary at age 8. That's how old she was. In 1863, Poland was in rebellion against Russian rule, and Tussie, that's what we called her, Tussie, wrote a letter to Engels about those brave little fellows in Poland, as she called them. When she was 9, she wrote a letter to America, advice to President Lincoln on how to win the war against the Confederacy. Also, she smoked and she drank. Still, she was a little child dressing up her little dolls while sipping from a glass of wine. I played chess with her when she was 10, and I could not easily defeat her. When she was 14, she became enraged at the law of observing the Lord's Day. No activity was permitted on Sunday. So she organized Sunday evenings for the people. St. Martin's Hall. She brought their musicians to play Handel, Mozart, Beethoven. The hall was packed. 2,000 people. It was completely illegal. And yet, no one was arrested. A lesson. If you're going to do something illegal, do it with 2,000 people. And Mozart. I used to read Shakespeare and Aeschylus and Dante aloud to her and her sisters, which she loved. Her room was a Shakespeare museum. She memorized Romeo and Juliet and insisted that I recite over and over again those lines when Romeo sees Juliet for the first time. The brightness of her cheek would shame those stars as daylight doth a lamp. Her eyes in heaven would, through the airy region, stream so bright that birds would sing and think it were not night. She was not always easy to live with. Oh, no. Do you know how embarrassing it is to have a child who finds flaws in your reasoning? She loved to argue with me about my writing. For instance, my essay on the Jewish question. Difficult to understand, I admit. Eleanor read it and immediately challenged me. She said, why are you singling out Jews as representatives of capitalism? They're not the only ones poisoned by commerce and greed. I said, I'm not singling out the Jews. I'm merely using them as a vivid example. In response, she began to wear a Jewish star. I'm a Jew, she announced. What could I say? I shrugged my shoulders. She said, that's a very Jewish gesture. She could be very annoying. She knew that my father had converted to Christianity. It wasn't convenient to be a Jew in Germany. Is it ever convenient to be a Jew anywhere? She also knew I'd been baptized, a fact which intrigued her. She once asked me, in the family called me Moore, because of my dark complexion. She said, Moore, I know you were baptized, but first you were circumcised, weren't you? Nothing embarrassed that girl. At such times, she was impossible. For instance, alongside her Jewish star, she began to wear a crucifix. Not because she was enamored of Christianity, but of the Irish and their struggle against British rule. She learned all about it from Lizzie Burns, Engels' love. Now, Lizzie was a mill girl and could not read. Engels spoke 9 languages. You would think this would make it difficult for them to communicate, but they were in love. Lizzie was very involved in the Irish struggle. Eleanor would visit all the time. The two of them would stay up all night and drink wine and sing Irish songs until they both fell asleep on the floor. There was that time, though, that terrible time, when they hanged 2 young Irishmen right there in Soho with a drunken crowd cheering. Those genteel English, with their afternoon tea and their public hangings. I understand you don't do that anymore. Only gas people, inject poison into their veins, burn them with electricity. Much more civilized. Yes, they hanged 2 young Irishmen just for wanting freedom from England. Eleanor wept and wept. I said, Tussie, you're only 15. You don't have to get so involved so soon in the horrors of the world. She said, that's the point, Moore. I'm 15. Yes, she was 15. She became enamored of any handsome, dashing young man who visited our flat. I could draw up a list for all the rest of her life. Eleanor was clever in politics, idiotic in love. There was Les Sagarets, hero of the Paris Commune. At least he was a Frenchman. Jenison's fellow was English. English men are like English food. Need I say more? Okay. Then there was Laura's lover, Lafarge. His public displays of ardor were absurd. He would put his hand on her ass. In public, as if it were the most natural thing in the world. Jenny defended him. She said, it's his Creole background. His family came to France from Cuba. As if in Cuba, everybody goes around with their hand on somebody's ass. Jenny was always trying to calm me down. She may have been successful with me. She was unsuccessful with my boils. Did you ever have boils? There isn't a sickness more odious. It plagued me all my life and led to stupid attempts to analyze me via my boils.
Marx is angry at the capitalist system because he has boils.
Imbeciles! How do they explain all of the revolutionaries who don't have boils? Well, they always come up with something. This one was breastfed by his mother until he was 10. That one was never toilet trained. This one was beaten by his father. As if one must be abnormal to resent exploitation. Every explanation except the obvious, that the capitalist system by its nature, its attack on the human spirit breeds rebellion. Oh yes, they say the capitalist system has become more humane since my time. Oh really? Just a few years ago, it was in the newspapers. Factory owners in North Carolina locked the doors on the women in their chicken factory. The reason? To make more profit. There was a fire. 25 workers were trapped, burned to death. Perhaps my boils did inflame my anger. But try working. Try sitting and writing with boils on your ass. And don't tell me about doctors. The doctors knew less than I did because the boils were mine. I could not sleep. And then I discovered something miraculous. water. As simple as that. Cloths soaked in warm water. Jenny would wake up if I cried out in the middle of the night and patiently apply those hot, soothing cloths. Sometimes if Jenny was sick, Lenchen would do that. Yes, Lenchen. Okay. Here we are, living in poverty in Soho, and Jenny's mother decides to send us Lenchen to help with the babies. We've just pawned all of our furniture, you understand, and suddenly we have a servant girl. That's how it is when you marry into the aristocracy. They don't send you money that you desperately need. They send you fine linen and silverware and a servant. Actually, not a bad idea. The servant can take the fine linen and silverware to the pawn shop and get some money. Lenchen did that many times. But she was never a servant. Jenny had a tremendous affection for her. The girls adored her. Whenever Jenny was sick, Lenchen was at her side, attending to her every need. But, yeah, yes, her presence created a tension between Jenny and me. I remember a scene. I came downstairs. Jenny said, "I saw you looking at Lenchen this morning." I said, I don't know what you mean. She said, "I mean the way a man looks at a woman." I still don't know what you mean. It was one of those conversations which could not possibly come to any good. All this was going on inside our tiny flat on Dean Street. Outside was London. Can you imagine London, 1858? Coster girls trying to sell a few rolls for a few pennies. Hurdy-gurdies, brass bands, magicians, fire-eaters, prostitutes, the organ grinder with his monkey, and always a beggar girl singing an Irish ballad. That's what I saw and heard as I made my way home from the British Museum under the gas lamps which had just been lit until I got to Dean Street. And then I'd have to slog through the mud and sewage, thinking about the care they took in paving the roads in the wealthy neighborhoods. Although I suppose it's only fitting the author of Das Kapital should have to slog through shit while writing his condemnation of the capitalist system. Jenny didn't sympathize with my wading through the mud. She said, "That's how it feels to me reading Das Kapital." Yeah. She was my severest critic, unsparing, honest. Is there anything more outrageous than an honest critic? The book troubled her, yes, Capital. She thought I would bore people from the start with my discussion of commodities, surplus value, exchange value. She thought it was too long, too detailed. She used the word ponderous. Imagine. She reminded me of what our trade union friend Peter Fox said when I gave him the book. He said, "I feel like a man who's been given an elephant for a gift." Yes, she said, "it is an elephant." I tried to explain, this is not the manifesto which is intended for the general public. It is an analysis. She said, "Let it be an analysis, but let it cry out like the manifesto. A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism." You know, she would say that excites a reader, a specter is haunting Europe. And then to irritate me, she would read out some lines from Capital. "The turnover of industrial capital is a combination of its period of production and time of circulation, and therefore embraces the entire process of production. The turnover of merchants' capital, on the other hand, being in reality nothing but an alienated movement of commodity capital, represents only the first phase in the metamorphosis of a commodity, CM, as the refluent movement of a specific capital, MC. CM is, from the mercantile point of view, the turnover of merchants' capital." Now I ask you, is that boring? All right, okay. All right. Perhaps it is a little boring. I admitted that to Jenny. She said, "There's no such thing as a little boring." Don't misunderstand. She did see Capital as a profound accomplishment. She understood that this showed that the capitalist system must, at a certain stage in history, come into being and enormously increase the productive forces of society, thereby vastly increasing the wealth of the world, but that it must, by its nature, distribute that wealth in such a way as to destroy the humanity of both the capitalist and the laborer, and how it must, by its nature, create its own grave diggers and give way to a new system. But are we reaching the people we want to reach? She would say. Jenny said, do you know why the censors have allowed it to be published? Because they cannot understand it. And they assume no one else will either. I reminded her that Capital was receiving favorable reviews. She reminded me that most of those reviews were written by Engels. That's true. I said, well, perhaps you're being critical of my work because you're unhappy with me. She said, you men, you never think your work deserves criticism, so you attribute it to something personal. Yes, more. My personal feelings are there. This is separate. Yes. Her personal feelings. Jenny was going through a terrible time then. I suppose I was to blame, but I did not know how to ease her anguish. You must understand, Jenny and I fell in love when I was 17. She was 19. She was marvelous looking. Long auburn hair, dark eyes. Her family took a liking to me right away. They were aristocrats. Aristocrats are always impressed with intellectuals. Her father and I would get into long discussions about Greek philosophy. I was just finishing my doctoral thesis on Democritus and Epicurus, but I was just beginning to see that up to this point, philosophers had only interpreted the world. The point is to change it. When we were married, Jenny followed me to Paris. We gave birth to Jenishin and Laura. We were happy in Paris, living on nothing, meeting our friends in a cafe. They also lived on nothing. What a bunch we were. Bakunin, the huge, shaggy anarchist. Engels, the handsome atheist. Heine, the saintly poet. Stirner, total misfit. Proudhon. Proudhon, who said, property is theft, but wanted some. Being poor in Paris is one thing. Being poor in London is another. We moved there with two children, and soon Jenny was pregnant again. Sometimes I felt she blamed me for always having to raise our children in a cold, damp flat where someone was always sick. Jenny came down with the smallpox. She recovered, but it left pockmarks on her face. I tried to tell her she was still beautiful, but it didn't help. I wish you could know Jenny. What she did for me cannot be calculated. And she understood that I simply could not get a job like other men. I did try once. I wrote a letter to the railroad for a position as a clerk. They responded as follows. Dr. Marx, we are honored at your request for a position here. We've never had a doctor of philosophy working for us as a clerk. However, as the position requires a legible handwriting, we must regretfully decline you. Okay. Jenny believed in my ideas, but she was impatient with what she considered the pretensions of high-level scholarship. Come down to earth, Herr Doktor, she would say. She wanted me to explain the theory of surplus value, for example, so that ordinary workers could understand it. I tried to tell her, no one can understand the theory of surplus value unless you first understand the labor theory of value. That labor is a special commodity whose value is determined by the cost of the means of subsistence, and yet gives value to all other commodities, a value which always exceeds the value of labor itself. And Jenny would say, No, that won't do. All you have to say is this. Your employer pays you the barest amount in wages, just enough for you to survive and work. But in return, by your labor power, he makes far greater than he pays you. So he gets richer and richer while you stay poor. All right. Okay. Let us suppose that only 100 individuals in all of world history have ever understood my theory of surplus value. It's still true. Just the other day, I was reading your United States Department of Labor statistics. There you have it. Your workers are producing more and more and receiving less and less in wages. What is the result? Just as I predicted, the richest 1% of Americans now own 40% of the wealth. And this is the great model of world capitalism, a nation that has not only robbed its own citizens, it's sucked in the wealth of the rest of the world. You see, Jenny was always trying to simplify ideas which were, by their nature, complex. She accused me of being a revolutionary second and academic first. Forget your intellectual readers, she would say. Address the workers. She called me arrogant and intolerant. She said, why do you attack other revolutionaries more vehemently than you attack the bourgeoisie? Proudhon, for instance. The man simply did not understand that we must applaud capitalism for its development of giant industry and then take them over. Proudhon thought we had to retreat into a more simple society. So when he wrote his book, The Philosophy of Poverty, I replied with my own book, The Poverty of Philosophy. I thought that was pretty clever. Jenny thought it was insulting. I suppose she was a better human being than I could ever be. She did encourage me to get off my behind and get involved in the cause of the London workers. She was with me when I was asked to address the very first meeting of the International Working Men's Association, St. Martin's Hall. Workers of all countries must unite against foreign policies which are criminal, which play upon national prejudices and squander in wars the people's blood and treasure. We must combine across national boundaries to vindicate in international affairs the simple laws of morals and justice. Workers of the world, unite! Jenny liked that. She kept the family going. Water cut off, the gas cut off. She never tired of the subject of female emancipation. She said the vitality of women was being sapped by being forced to stay at home and cook and sew, so she refused to stay at home. She accused Engels and I of being theoretically emancipationist but practically ignorant of the problems of women. You and Engels, she said, you write about sexual equality, but you do not practice it. Well, I won't comment on that. She supported with all her heart the Irish struggle. Queen Victoria had said, these Irish are really abominable people, not at all like any other civilized nation. So Jenny wrote a letter to the London newspapers. England hangs Irish rebels for wanting freedom. Is England a civilized nation? Jenny and I were powerfully in love. How can I make you understand that? Yes, there were difficult times in Soho, Paris. But the love was still there. At a certain point, things changed. I don't know why. Jenny said it was because she was no longer the great beauty I had wooed. That made me angry. Then she said it was because of luncheon. That made me even more angry. Then she said I was angry because it was true. It made me furious. So they keep saying that since the Soviet Union collapsed, communism is dead. Communism is dead. Do these idiots know what communism is? Do they think a system run by a thug who murders his fellow revolutionaries is communism? Scheiß. Journalists, politicians who say such things, what education did they have? Did they read the Communist Manifesto, which Engels and I wrote when he was 28 and I was 30? In place of bourgeois society with its classes and class antagonisms, we shall have a free association in which the free development of each is the precondition for the free development of all. Do you hear that? An association. What do they think the purpose of communism is? freedom for the individual to develop himself or herself as a compassionate human being? Do they think someone who calls himself a socialist or communist and acts like a gangster understands what communism is? To shoot those who disagree with you. Could that be the communism that I gave my life for? That monster in Russia who took all power for himself and insisted on interpreting my ideas like a religious fanatic when he was lining up his old comrades before a firing squad. Did he allow his citizens to read the letter that I wrote to the New York Tribune in which I said that capital punishment could not be justified in any society calling itself civilized? Socialism is not supposed to reproduce the stupidities of capitalism. Here in America, your prisons are overcrowded. Gesundheit. Who is in the prisons? The poor. Now, sure, some of them have committed terrible, violent crimes. Most of them are burglars, robbers, thieves, sellers of drugs. They believe in free enterprise. They do what the capitalists do, but on a much smaller scale. Do you know what Engels and I wrote about prisons? Rather than imprison individuals for their crimes, we should destroy the social conditions which engender crime and give to each person the scope he needs to develop himself in society. Yes, we spoke of a dictatorship of the proletariat. Not a dictatorship of one man, not a dictatorship of one party, one central committee, a temporary dictatorship of the proletariat, the mass of people, would take over the state and govern in the interests of all, till the state itself eventually became unnecessary and would gradually wither away. Bakunin, of course, disagreed. He thought a state, even a worker state, if it had police, an army, prisons, would eventually become a tyranny. He loved to argue with me. Do you know him? Bakunin, the anarchist. If a novelist invented such a character, you would say the existence of such a person is not possible. To say that Bakunin and I did not get along is a great understatement. For instance, listen to what he wrote when Engels and I were in Brussels working on the manifesto. Marx and Engels, and especially Marx, are ingrained bourgeois. We are ingrained bourgeois. Of course, to Bakunin, everyone was bourgeois because he chose to live like a pig. If you did not live like a pig, if you had a roof over your head, if you occasionally enjoyed some fresh bread and wine, if you had a piano in your sitting room, you were a bourgeois. Now, I grant the man courage. He was imprisoned, sent to Siberia, escaped. He wandered the world trying to foment revolution everywhere. He wanted an anarchist society. The only anarchism he ever succeeded in setting up was in his own mind. He tried to start an uprising in Bologna. He almost shot himself with his own revolver. His revolutions failed miserably everywhere, but he was like a man whose failure with women just spurs him on to more. Did you ever see a photograph of Bakunin? Giant of a man. Massive beard. Ferocious expression. Bald head, which he covered with a small gray cap. No teeth. Scurvy, the result of his prison diet. He seemed to live not in this world, but in some world of his imagination. He had no concept of money. When he had it, he gave it away. When he didn't have it, he borrowed it without any thought of returning it. He had no home. Or you could say the world was his home. He would arrive at a comrade's doorstep unannounced and say, "I'm here. Where do I sleep? And what is there to eat?" And in an hour, he was more at home than his host. There was that time we were having dinner in Soho. Bakunin burst in. Didn't bother to knock. It was his habit to arrive right at dinner time. We were surprised. We thought he was in Italy somewhere. Whenever we heard about him, he was off organizing a revolution. This time he practically knocked the door off its hinges, came in, looked around, smiled his toothless smile. He said, "Good evening, comrades." Sat down at the table and began devouring meat and sausage in enormous chunks, stuffing in fistfuls of cheese and downing it with glass after glass of brandy. I said, "Mikhail, try the wine. Brandy's expensive. We have plenty of wine." He took one sip of wine. He spat it out. "Brandy helps you think more clearly." Bakunin's head was full of... And then he stood up and began his usual peroration, preaching, shouting, ordering, exhorting. I was furious. It was Jenny who finally spoke up. She said, "Stop it, Mikhail. You're consuming all of the oxygen in the room." Bakunin said was full of all kinds of anarchist garbage. Romantic, utopian nonsense. I wanted to expel him from the International. Jenny said, why do revolutionary groups with 6 members always threaten somebody with expulsion? I don't know. Well, police were looking for him in every country in Europe. When he came to us, he was dressed as a priest. At least he thought so. He looked ridiculous. Well, he was with us a week. One night, we stayed up all night drinking and arguing, drinking some more till neither of us could stand. In fact, I fell asleep in the midst of one of Bakunin's perorations. He shook me until I woke up. He said, I haven't finished my point. It was that glorious time in the winter of 1871. The commune was in power in Paris. Paris Commune. Bakunin leapt with his full bulk into that revolution. The French understood him. They had a saying, on the first day of a revolution, Bakunin is a treasure. On the second day, he should be shot. Yeah. Do you know that magnificent episode in human history, Paris Commune? The story begins with stupidity. I'm speaking of Napoleon III, nephew of Bonaparte. He was a stage actor, smiling to the crowd. Meanwhile, 6 million French peasants lived in blind, dark hovels, their children dying of starvation. But because he kept a legislature, because people voted, it was thought they had a democracy. A common mistake. Well, Bonaparte wanted glory, so he decided to attack Bismarck's armies. He was quickly defeated, whereupon the victorious German troops marched into Paris and were greeted by something more devastating than guns. Silence. The statues of Paris were draped in enormous black cloths. An immense, invisible, silent resistance. The Germans did the wise thing. They paraded through the Arc de Triomphe and quickly departed. Now, the old order, the Republic, the French liberals, they called themselves, they were trembling with fear. They were afraid to enter the city because now, with the German soldiers gone, Paris was taken over by the workers, the housewives, the clerks, the intellectuals, the armed citizens, the people of Paris formed not a government, something more glorious, something governments everywhere fear. The commune, collective energy of the people. The French army encircled and threatened to invade at any moment. Paris became the first free city in the world, an enclave of liberty in a world of tyranny. I said to Bakunin, do you want to know what I mean by the dictatorship of the proletariat? Look at the Paris Commune. That is real democracy, not the democracy of England or America, where elections are circuses, where the choice is between this or that guardian of the old order, and whichever candidate wins, the rich go on ruling the country. No, it only lasted 2 months. The Paris Commune was the first legislative body in history to represent the poor. Its laws were for them. It abolished their debts, postponed their rents. They forced the pawn shops to return their most needed possessions. They lowered the hours of bakers. They refused to take wages higher than those of the workers. And they set up a commission for the education of women, something unheard of, education for women. They took advantage of the latest in science, the lighter-than-air balloon, and they launched one out from Paris to float over the countryside and drop printed papers to the peasants. With a simple, powerful message. A message that should be dropped to working people everywhere. Our interests are the same. The commune declared the purpose of schools, to teach children to love and respect their fellow creatures. Now, I've read your endless discussions on education. Such nonsense. You teach everything necessary to succeed in a capitalist world, but do you teach the youth to struggle for justice? The commune understood the importance of that. They educated not only by their words, but by their acts. They abolished the guillotine, that instrument of tyranny, even revolutionary tyranny. And then, wearing red bandanas, red banner flying, buildings festooned in sheets of red silk, they gathered around the Vendome Column, a symbol of military power, an enormous statue surmounted by the giant bronze head of Napoleon Bonaparte. A pulley was attached to the head, a capstan turned, and the head came crashing to the ground. Men and women climbed atop the ruins. Now the red flag flew from its pedestal. Now it was a statue not of one nation, but of the entire human race. And men and women watching wept with joy. That was the Paris Commune. People shared things. Kindness ruled. They seemed to smile more often. The streets were completely safe without police of any kind. Yes, that was socialism. Of course, that example could not be allowed. So the French army invaded and commenced a slaughter. The leaders of the commune were taken to Père Lachaise Cemetery, lined up against a wall, and shot. Altogether, 30,000 were killed. Commune was crushed by wolves, swine. Still, it was the most glorious achievement of our time. Bakunin and I drank and argued and drank some more. It was getting late. I said, Mikhail, you simply don't understand the concept of a proletarian state. We cannot simply throw off the past in one orgasmic moment. We must remake society anew from the remnants of the old. That takes time. He said, no. The people must live in freedom immediately or begin to lose it. It was getting late. I became impatient. It started to get personal. I said, Mikhail, you're too stupid to understand. The brandy was having an effect on him, too. He said, no, you're too stupid to understand. You arrogant son of a bitch. You think workers will make a revolution based on your theories. Workers give a shit about your theories. The instinct for revolution is in their bellies, and they'll rise up without your so-called science. I spit on your theories. And as he said that, he spat on the floor. What a pig. I said, you can spit on my theories, not on my floor. Clean it immediately. He said, there, I always knew you were a bully. I said, I always knew you were a eunuch. He roared. Sounded like a prehistoric animal. And then he leapt on top of me. You must understand, the man was enormous. We wrestled on the floor back and forth. We were too drunk to really hurt one another. Finally, we just lay there, catching our breath. And then he rose, like a hippopotamus rising out of a river. He went over to the window, unbuttoned his trousers, and began to urinate out the window. I said, what are you doing? He said, what do you think I'm doing? I'm pissing out the window. I said, that's disgusting. He said, I'm pissing on London. I'm pissing on the whole British Empire. I said, no, you're pissing on my street. He didn't respond. He just buttoned up his trousers, lay down on the floor, and began to snore. I closed my eyes. I was soon unconscious as well. Jenny found us both like that. When she awoke, the dawn. No. They could not allow the commune to exist. It was too dangerous, too inspiring an example for the rest of the world, so they drowned it in blood. Still happens, huh? Does it not? Whenever people in some corner of the world begin experimenting with new ways of living. People innocent of ideology, just angry about their lives. It cannot be allowed. So they go to work. You know who I mean by they. Sometimes insidiously, covertly, sometimes directly, violently. Crush it. So they keep saying that capitalism has triumphed. Capitalism has triumphed. Why? Because the stock market rises to the sky. Stockholders are even wealthier than before. Triumphed. 1/4 of American children live in poverty. 20,000 of them die each year before their first birthday. New York City. 100,000 people lined up this morning for 2,000 jobs. I wonder, what will become of the 98,000 who are turned away? Is that why you're building more prisons? Yes, capitalism has triumphed, but over whom? Sure, you have technological marvels. You have sent men into the stratosphere. But what of those who are left here on Earth? Why are they so fearful? Why do they turn to drugs and alcohol, go berserk and kill? It's in the newspapers. And your politicians are bloated with pride. They say, we'll now move to the free enterprise system. Has everyone become stupid? Don't you know the history of the free enterprise system? When government did nothing for the people and did everything for the rich. When your government gave 13 million acres of land free to the railroads and then looked away as Chinese immigrants and Irish immigrants worked on those railroads 10 to 12 hours a day and died in the heat and the cold. And when they rebelled and went on strike, your government sent armies to smash them into submission. Why the hell do you think I wrote Das Kapital? If not that I could see the misery of the free enterprise system. In England, little children went to work in the textile mills because their tiny fingers could work the spindles. In America, young girls went to work in the mills of Massachusetts at age 10 and died at age 25. Cities were cesspools of vice and poverty. That is capitalism, then and now. Oh, yes, I see all of the luxuries advertised in your magazines and on your, on your screens. So many screens, so many pictures. You see so much and know so little. Doesn't anybody read history anymore? What kind of shit do they teach in schools these days? Oh, my goodness. All right.
Okay, all right, okay.
They're so sensitive.
Okay. I wish Jenny could be here.
She would have something to say about all of this.
I watched her die. Sick. Miserable in the end. Surely she remembered our moments of pleasure, even ecstasy. In Paris. Soho. I miss my daughters.
Anniversary of Gulf War. A victory short and sweet. Oh, yes. I too know these short, sweet wars that leave thousands of corpses on the battlefield, children dying from a lack of food and medicine in Europe, Africa, Palestine, people killing each other over boundaries. Didn't you hear what I said 160 years ago? Wipe out these ridiculous national boundaries. No more border guards, no more immigration quotas, no more pledges of allegiance to some artificial entity called a nation. Workers of the world, unite! My backside is killing me.
I confess, I did not reckon on capitalism's ingeniousness in surviving. I didn't imagine there would be drugs to keep the sick system alive, wars to keep the industries running, religious fanatics promising the return of Jesus. I know Jesus. He's not coming back. I admit, I was wrong in 1848, thinking capitalism was on its way out. My timing was a bit off. 200 years. But it will be transformed. All the present systems will be transformed. I keep thinking about what your President Lincoln used to say. You cannot fool all of the people all of the time. Their sense of justice, their instinct for decency will bring them together. And when it does, the rulers of society, with all their wealth, with all their armies, will be powerless to prevent it. Their servants will refuse to serve. Their soldiers will disobey orders. Oh, yes, it has happened before. It can happen again, and on a much larger scale. Oh, yes, capitalism has produced wonders unsurpassed in world history, miracles of technology and science. But it is also producing its own death, its own voracious appetite for profit. More, 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 more. It's a world of turmoil. It turns everything, literature, art, music, beauty itself, into commodities to be bought and sold. It turns people into commodities. And not just the factory worker, the lawyer, the physician, the poet, the artist, all must sell themselves in order to survive. And what will happen when they all realize they're workers and that they have a common enemy? They'll join together to fulfill themselves. And not just in one country, because capitalism needs a world market. Its cry is free trade, so that it may more freely roam all over the globe in search of profit, more, 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 more. But in doing so, it unwittingly creates a world culture. People cross borders as never before. Ideas cross borders. Something new is bound to come of this. When I was in Paris with Jenny in 1843, I wrote that in the new industrial system, people are estranged from their work because it is distasteful to them. They're estranged from nature. Smoke, smells, noise invade their senses. Progress, it is called. They're estranged from each other. As everyone is set against everyone else, scrambling for survival, and they're estranged from themselves, living lives which are not their own, living as they do not actually want to live, so that a good life seems possible only in dreams, in fantasy. But it does not have to be so. There is still a possibility of choice, only a possibility. I grant, nothing is certain. Now that is clear. I was too damn certain. Anything can happen. People must get off their asses. Does that sound too radical for you? Remember, to be radical, simply to grasp the root of a problem. And the root is us. I have a suggestion. Pretend you have boils. Pretend sitting on your ass gives you enormous pain. So you must get up, you must move, you must act. Let's not talk anymore of capitalism, socialism. Let's just talk of using the incredible wealth of the earth for human beings. Give people what they need. Food, water, clean air, pleasant homes to live in, trees, some grass, some hours of work, more hours of leisure. Don't ask who deserves it. Every human being deserves it. Well, it's time to go. Do you resent me? Coming back, irritating you like this? Look at it this way. It is the second coming. Christ couldn't make it. So Marx came.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.